Thank you very much, Father. Good evening, everyone. It's a great pleasure to be back at St. Mary's, now in its new dignity of a minor basilica, which is better than being no basilica at all. I asked Hillary when I came in, where's the umbraculum? The Italians call it the umbrellino, umbrellone. It's a big, pointed, golden red umbrella that will be in here sooner or later. It's a sign of a basilica. It goes back to the old Roman basilicas, and it was carried over the head of the Pope so that nothing untoward would drop on him. Now, as you're about to find out, those of you who didn't know it already, I am something of a second-class relic in respect of St. John Paul II. So maybe I can have the umbraculum carried over me the next time I come here. I also want to extend my sympathies to Father Hathaway on the death of his mother. I understand she was buried today. So we will certainly keep Mrs. Hathaway and the whole family in our prayers. This book, which I'm presenting to you tonight, and which all of you will rush across the street to the Lyceum afterwards to buy and have me sign for you. You can laugh, that's okay. You can laugh, but you have to go across the street and buy. Really begins about 13 years ago, on the night of December 15th, 2004. I was having what turned out to be my last supper with John Paul II, as had become our custom in the weeks before Christmas. And at the end of that evening, as I was leaving the papal apartment, I said to him, in respect of the work I had already done on his life, Holy Father, if you don't bury me, I promise you that I will finish what I began. The first volume of my John Paul II biography, Witness to Hope, of course, only took the story up through late 1998, early 1999, and there was more to tell. So I promised him I would finish what I started. And when the second volume of the biography, The End and the Beginning, came out in 2010, I felt that I had fulfilled that promise. In fact, I think we may have even had a book event for that book here. In any case, what I learned, though, when I was going around the country and the world explaining this second volume was that my audiences were not really interested in the new facts I had brought forward about the dramatic life of John Paul II, nor were they particularly interested in my long 120-page wrap-up of his life and accomplishments. What people wanted were stories. Anecdotes, personal reminiscences, anything that would bring him back alive. He had, of course, died in 2005. The beatification was clearly on the horizon with the canonization to follow. And I think people had this sense that we often get of people drifting off into some unimaginable realm of sanctity where we really can't touch them anymore, and people wanted that. They wanted to be able to be with John Paul II again, at least through stories. And the more I thought about that, the more it occurred to me that that impulse to know someone better, to know a great figure, a holy figure, in a more personal way, was the instinct that had inspired the more popular lives of the saints throughout the history of the church. So it began to occur to me that while I had produced two volumes of scholarly biography amounting to some 1,600 pages of text and notes, perhaps I hadn't fulfilled that promise I had made to the Pope on December 15th, 2004. Perhaps there were more stories to tell, more anecdotes to share, more to write in order to bring him alive to people in a more personal way. And that thought is the genesis of this new book, Lessons in Hope, My Unexpected Life with St. John Paul II. Those of you who have read Witness to Hope and The End and the Beginning will be delighted to know that unlike its two predecessor volumes, this book does not have a single footnote or endnote in it. You can read it in bed without damaging your pectoral muscles here. It's very reader-friendly, I hope. It's a collection of stories. Stories about my encounters with him, primarily, but stories also about what led me to this unexpected vocation of becoming the biographer of a saint who was, I believe, the emblematic human figure of the second half of the 20th century. When it came time to do this, to actually write this, I decided to organize the book around two things that the Pope had said. The first of these things he had said to me in March 1996. We had had a long and pleasant dinner discussing how it was that we were going to make this project of my writing his biography work. And as he was walking me out of the papal apartment that night, he said to me, in respect of other biographies, they try to understand me from the outside, but I can only be understood from inside. He didn't say it in a hostile way or an aggressive way or an angry way, but almost an amusing sort of way, thinking about the oddities of biographers. And of course, that was true. Those who had tried this before, thinking particularly of Tad Schultz's book, Pope John Paul II, The Biography, had only seen the outside, had only seen the figure on the public stage, and simply were not interested, it seemed, in what made him tick. Spiritually, intellectually, emotionally. It was just all outside all the time. I remember one reviewer of that Schultz book saying, this is like a biography of Michael Jordan written by someone who doesn't know or care about basketball. It's just not going to work too well. You might get a few interesting bits and pieces, but you weren't going to really get inside the character. And as I pondered over the next 3 years how it was that I was going to tell the story of this man from the inside out, several things became clear to me that I think are still very important to reflect upon today. The first of these was that this was a pope, a world leader who prayed his way into all of his great decisions. As I came to know his story better, it became clearer and clearer to me that while he was a man of a very keen mind, a man of constant conversation with others who sought counsel from all sorts of people, many of whom not used to being consulted by popes. What fundamentally informed the decisions he made, the initiatives he took, the appointments he made of bishops and other officials was his life of prayer. There is nothing in this pontificate in its most dramatic expressions. The creation of World Youth Day, the remarkable 9 days in Poland in June 1979, his first pilgrimage home, days on which you can really, in retrospect, feel the wheel of history turning in a better direction. The initiative of the Great Jubilee of 2000, his pilgrimage to the Holy Land, the completion of a diplomatic agreement between the Holy See and the State of Israel, and on and on and on. All of the great encyclicals. These things were prayed into being. They were thought into being, they were consulted into being, but fundamentally they were prayed into being. And one of the great examples of that had to do with the appointment of an Archbishop of Paris. In 1984, the Archbishop of Paris, Cardinal Marti, reached the retirement age. A list of potential candidates was submitted to John Paul II. He wasn't terribly impressed by it. And he prayed his way into what was arguably the boldest episcopal appointment of his pontificate. It involved a man with a very striking background. His name was Jean-Marie Lustiger. His parents were Polish Jews who had emigrated to France during the 1920s, where he was born. During the Second World War, his mother was murdered in the Auschwitz extermination camp. His father died of other causes shortly after the war. He had been hidden with a Catholic family in the south of France, and through that experience converted to Catholicism, attended the Sorbonne as a student of political theory, discerned a vocation to the priesthood, and eventually returned to the Sorbonne as its chaplain. Early in John Paul II's pontificate, he had been appointed the Bishop of Orléans in France. And now John Paul II had prayed his way into the idea that this man who had absolutely none of the background of an Archbishop of Paris, going back to St. Denis, ought to be the Archbishop of Paris. So he decides on the appointment. The Vatican representative in France, the nuncio, calls Bishop Lustiger in Orléans, says the Holy Father wishes to appoint you the Archbishop of Paris. And Lustiger says, that's impossible, he can't do it. It is simply impossible for a man of my background to be the Archbishop of Paris. So thanks, but no thanks. Merci, mais non merci. So this word gets back to Rome, and there's a bit of further discussion. And then the Pope's secretary, Stanisław Dziwisz, is sent to Orléans. And he says to Bishop Lustiger, Your Excellency, you are not a bright idea of the Pope's. He's not trying to do this to be different. You are the fruit of the prayer of the Holy Father. You are the fruit of the prayer of the Holy Father. At which point, what are you going to say? So Lustiger, who would become a very good friend and a great source for Witness to Hope, accepted the appointment and began a remarkable 25-year run as the Archbishop of Paris. I think the same thing was true of World Youth Day. When John Paul floated the idea in 1982 or 83 of having an international youth festival built around the sacraments and the Pope, he was told by his curial officials, "You're crazy. You can't do this. It won't work. Young people live on a different planet, planet Zongo or wherever, you know. They're just not interested in what we have to offer." But John Paul II, who of course had a remarkable experience as a university chaplain himself in the first years of his priesthood, prayed his way into the idea that this was the right thing to do. And of course, this bold initiative, I mean, who would have imagined in October 1978, when he was elected, that a gathering of a million young people every two or three years would become of around the Pope and the sacraments would become a regular part of the rhythm of global Catholic life. He prayed that into being. So I hope one thing that readers of this book come to is a deeper appreciation of him as a man for whom the most important hour of the day was the first hour of the day, when he was in prayer by himself in the chapel of the papal apartment, laying all of his problems before the Lord, but also praying his way into the great initiatives and decisions of the pontificate. Second thing this book and this attempt to show the Pope even more deeply from inside allows me to do is to tell the stories of the remarkable cast of characters that surrounded Karol Wojtyła, Pope John Paul II, throughout his life. People who helped form him into the man he became, people in whom he reposed trust when he was at the pinnacle of Catholic life. Early in our conversations in 1996, John Paul II said to me, "If you want to understand me from the inside, you must meet my," and then he used this Polish word which I didn't know, "you must meet my środowisko." Środowisko is an essentially untranslatable Polish word that means something like environment or milieu, surround, we might say. I said, "Okay, that's great. I'd be delighted to meet these people. What is it? Who are they? What is this that I'm supposed to get to know here?" Środowisko was the name adopted for themselves by the network of university students that young Father Karol Wojtyła had served as a chaplain in the late 1940s and early 1950s. And by the time I came to meet this gang, it was now in its third generation. So the original Wojtyła kids had gotten married and had kids, and their kids had kids, and this whole kit and caboodle called itself Środowisko. And as I got to know these, at that point, middle-aged men and women from the original group, some of whom have become very close personal friends of mine, I came to understand that another facet of this inside-out Pope was what one of the members of the group called his permanent openness, his ability and indeed his desire to meet another person wisely, to hear what that other person had to say, and in his role as priest, confessor, and spiritual director, to help that other person discern the path that God intended for them. And as I talked to these once young friends of his, many of whom were now were in the late 1990s, distinguished professionals, I began to understand something important. Yes, it is true that he formed them, as you would expect a chaplain or spiritual director or confessor to do, he formed them into mature Christian men and women, helped them begin raising their families, all that sort of thing. But they were also forming him. They were forming him into one of the most dynamic and effective priests and bishop of his generation. And that mutual exchange of gifts, if you will, to use a term from ecumenical theology, could not have happened without this characteristic of permanent openness on his part. He was open to what they were teaching him about experiences he hadn't had, like courtship, like marriage, like raising small children, et cetera, et cetera. As it happens, 3.5 years ago, when I was teaching in Krakow, which I do every summer, I had invited my son Stephen to come over to do some photography for one of the books that Father mentioned, City of Saints, a kind of guidebook to Krakow. And as it happened, it was in those days the 50th wedding anniversary of one of these Wojtyła couples, who are very, very good friends of mine. The gentleman in question is a very distinguished nuclear physicist. His wife is a very distinguished musician. So they invited my son and me to their 50th wedding anniversary mass in Wawel Cathedral, which was very nice. And afterwards, we're standing outside, and there are all these other former Wojtyła kids to the second and third generation, but a lot of the original gang going back to the late 1940s. And these are people who are now in their 70s and 80s. And as Poles do on such occasions, they're simply flooding the anniversary couple with huge bunches of flowers. And my son and I were standing off to the side. And I said, Stephen, what you are looking at is the beginning of World Youth Day. World Youth Day did not begin with an idea of the Pope's in 1983. World Youth Day began with these people. These are the original World Youth Day people, because it was his experience with them and the permanent openness that characterized that that could lead him to the bold decision to create this new feature of the global life of the church. Another characteristic of John Paul II from the inside that I think reflects both the intensity of his spiritual life and his conviction that he was being guided by the hand of the Lord, and this quality of permanent openness, which I describe in here in a couple of anecdotes, is his willingness to kind of push the envelope in terms of who he brought into his inner circle and relied upon for information and counsel. And my favorite story of that cast of characters in here involves a remarkable woman, Russian by birth, family left after the revolution of 1917. She marries an Italian diplomat. They have two sons. Her husband's a bit older, so he dies shortly after the boys have become adults. And Irina Alberti, as she was named by marriage, took a job as Alexander Solzhenitsyn's secretary and housekeeper in Cavendish, Vermont. And she worked for the great Solzhenitsyn for 6 or 7 years, and then returned to Paris where her family had settled after leaving Russia. And in the early 1980s, came to Rome on a kind of holiday trip with a friend. And the friend had good connections and arranged for the two of them to be in the front row of a Wednesday papal audience. So after the audience, the Pope is working the line and comes to Mrs. Alberti, and she greets him in Russian. And he responds in Russian. And then they have a brief conversation in French. And as he's walking away, he looks back over his shoulder and says to her, "The next time you're in town, give me a call and come to lunch." So when she gets back to Paris, she goes to see her spiritual director and says, "Pope just told me to give him a call and come to lunch. How do I do that?" This guy had enough sense to say, "You just call the Vatican switchboard and ask for Monsignor Jivish, the Pope's secretary, and this will all get sorted out." So she did. And that began a personal friendship with John Paul II that led her to introduce him to Andrei Sakharov and his wife Elena Bonner, and to become John Paul II's personal secret agent in the Soviet Union in its last years and in post-Soviet Russia. She would go back to Russia every couple of months, and as she said to me, if I learned anything interesting, I would call him up and we'd meet and I would tell him. Now, that's an interesting story in its own right, as is other stories, as are other stories of her conversations with him in here. But what the point I want to underline right now is that only a man secure in his own relationship with the Lord, secure in his own confidence and his ability to read other personalities and to make judgments about people, would have had the nerve to do that. Much to the aggravation of the usual managers of popes in the Vatican. I mean, who on earth is this Russian woman running around here and telling the Pope what we're supposed to be telling him? Well, of course, you know, the point is that she had sources of information and contacts that Vatican diplomacy would never have touched, and he wanted to be in touch with that. Another episode, which of course wouldn't have fit appropriately in either of the previous two books, but very much touched me, and again, I think helps explain John Paul II from inside, takes us back to that last dinner on December 15th, 2004. My father had died the previous October 19th. The Pope had sent a telegram to be read at the funeral, which was very kind of him. But that was 2 months before this dinner meeting. He was in pretty tough shape himself at that point with this awful Parkinson's disease. And yet, when I walked into the dining room that night, the first thing he said to me was, "How is your mother?" Not hi, not hello, not happy Advent, not Merry Christmas, not whatever. How is your mother? I mean, the pastor's mind and heart still, the heart beating strongly 6 weeks before his final illness. So there's a lot of inside John Paul II here. The second thing he said that shapes this book took place on May 13th, 1982. Many of you will immediately recognize the date. as the first anniversary of the assassination attempt of May 13th, 1981. And the Pope had gone to Fatima on a pilgrimage of thanksgiving for his life having been spared. When he got off the plane in Lisbon, in the course of his arrival remarks, he said again in this musing sort of way, in the designs of Providence, there are no mere coincidences. In the designs of Providence, there are no mere coincidences. What we think of as coincidental or happenstance or random is simply one piece of the puzzle of the providential ordering of our lives that we haven't quite got fit into the frame yet. The world may have thought that it was completely coincidental that he had been shot on the liturgical feast of Our Lady of Fatima. He didn't think that was coincidental at all, because as he said on so many occasions, one hand fired and another guided the bullet. And given the fact that a professional assassin was standing as close to him as this lady is to me, firing point blank with nothing in between them, and the bullet that hit his abdomen missed his abdominal aorta by 2 millimeters, you know, you could begin to understand, you know, what he meant here. This led me, this notion of providential coincidence, to look at my own life in a different framework, through a different prism. So the first quarter of this book explores the providential coincidences that led me utterly unexpectedly to become the biographer of John Paul II. And the first of these, of those stories, is perhaps my favorite of the whole bunch. And it takes you back to March 1960 in the old Cathedral School in downtown Baltimore. The Friday before Ash Wednesday that year, the principal of the school, who had the spectacular name of Sister Mary Euphemia, comes on the PA, as she did every morning, to lead the morning prayers and the Pledge of Allegiance. But this day she says, okay, boys and girls, next Wednesday is Ash Wednesday, and each class in the school is going to spend Lent praying for the conversion of a communist dictator. This was Cold War America. Now, if you are, as I was, 8 years old at that point, you have only heard of one communist dictator, and that was Mr. Nikita Khrushchev, whom the elder folks here will remember, who had, as you may also remember, been banging his shoe on a table at the United Nations, which tended to get everybody's attention. So, we in the third grade naturally hoped that our designated miscreant and prayee would be Mr. Khrushchev. So, comes Ash Wednesday morning, we are marched across the street to Benjamin Latrobe's magnificent Cathedral of the Assumption. We get ashed. We come back, and Sister Mary Florence starts to write the name of our guy on the board. And we all just look. And I don't know whether I'm creating this memory in retrospect, but I'm sure some of us, and perhaps even me, thought, whatever language that is, it needs a few less consonants and a few more vowels. Well, that was Mr. Władysław Gomułka, the head of the Polish Communist Party. And if you had said to me in March 1960, okay, 32 years from now, you will publish a book about, among other things, Polish church-state relations in which that guy is going to play a prominent role, I would have thought you were certifiably mad. But in retrospect, I have to say you cannot convince me now that that little episode of 6.5 weeks of prayer for Comrade Gomulka's soul, which at least on the historical record available were not efficacious, because he stayed a bad guy all the way to the end, I did not plant a seed in my head that would flower some years later. The same is true of my college studies. I was a philosophy major in college, and I had absolutely no idea when I was hacking my way through the thickets of Edmund Husserl, the founder of phenomenology, in a contemporary European philosophy course in the fall of 1972. And when I say hacking my way through, I'm not exaggerating, because I am absolutely convinced that Edmund Husserl was one of the three worst writers who ever put pen to paper in the history of writing. Unbelievably dense and convoluted. If you had told me then that within 30 years I would be explicating Husserl and his influence on people like John Paul II, St. Edith Stein, Dietrich von Hildebrand, I would have said, you know, come on, what are we talking about here? And yet there it was. So all of that preparation having an unexpected but providential fruition. The same is true of many things that I did here in the Washington area in the early to mid 1980s. I was doing some work in the Congress. We formed a bipartisan caucus in support of persecuted Lithuanian priests and nuns, managed to get several of them out of the gulag camps in which they were incarcerated. But I mean, at the time, that just simply seemed to me a good thing to do. So I did it. Yet that was another remote preparation for taking on a biography of John Paul II, as was the appeal for religious freedom in the Soviet Union that I instigated in 1987 with an eye towards the millennium of Christianity. But again, that just seemed a good thing to do. But here was another piece of the puzzle that fell into place only some 15 years later. Perhaps the most striking of these was a week I spent in Moscow in October 1990. I had been invited to go with a group of scholars and human rights activists organized by the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington. And we spent a week meeting with people who thought of themselves as the democratic opposition to Mr. Gorbachev. It was a completely stunning week, but two things happened there that would have a profound influence on my thinking and ultimately on my life. In terms of my thinking, I mean, I had been involved in various human rights activities in communist countries for a decade at that point, and I knew how deeply atheism was in the DNA of the communist project. But it was not until a friend and I, colleague on this trip, with 2 hours off in the course of these meetings, asked a young Russian who had been hanging around our hotel lobby, obviously wanting to practice his English, if he knew his way around the Kremlin, which he did. So we hired him to give us a very quick tour of the Kremlin. Inside the Kremlin are three very large and quite beautiful churches, which in Russian Orthodox terminology are called cathedrals. And as we're coming up a stone stairway in one of these places, which had all been restored for this 1988 millennium celebration I was telling you about, we came up this stone stairway to a medieval fresco, which had just been restored, very large, perhaps 20 feet by 8 feet, And it was the Last Supper. And it couldn't have been anything other than the Last Supper. I mean, you couldn't miss this as the Last Supper. And yet this very bright 25-year-old Russian lad said to my colleague and me, in complete innocence, "Please tell me, who are those men and what are they doing?" Now, you know, as I say, I had read a whole lot of stuff about the Communist Project. I had been involved in resisting these people. I knew theoretically that there had been a profound cultural warping because of this. But here is this young man standing right beside me who doesn't have any idea what one of the three great images of the Christian tradition is. I mean, you know, the manger and Christmas, Calvary and the crucifixion, and the Last Supper. I mean, if you don't know that, you know, where have you been? And that's where he had been. He had been in a country that had culturally lobotomized its young people, that had denied them an essential aspect of their own culture. It left a profound impression on me, and over time would give me, I think, some insight into what Karol Wojtyla and other church leaders in Central and Eastern Europe were fighting against during those years. It was also on the flight back from that trip to Moscow, somewhere 40,000 feet over the Atlantic, I was so amped up from this previous week that I just couldn't get to sleep. And as I was going through this swirling kaleidoscope of images in my head, the thought came into my mind, okay, what am I doing here in the belly of the beast? And it's possible to be having real conversations with real Russians about the democratic transition of their country. How the heck did this happen? Because it was clearly a continuation of what had happened the year before in Central and Eastern Europe, the fall of the wall and whatnot. And then the thought came into my head, the church and the Pope must have had something to do with this. So the next morning, I called my editor at what was then my publisher, Oxford University Press, and I said, we should get together for a drink tonight, which we did. And I said, look, I've just been in Moscow for a week. This is really quite astonishing what's going on in that part of the world. The church and the Pope must have had something to do with it. I would like to figure out what that was, and I think that'll make a great book for you. And so it was. And that was the beginning of the book called The Final Revolution, The Resistance Church and the Collapse of Communism. And as I narrate in here, that book was the beginning of my intense conversation with John Paul II. Now, I would have had absolutely no idea flying home from Moscow in October 1990 that the next literally 20 plus years were being set in motion by what happened that week, and yet there it is. In the designs of Providence, there are no mere coincidences. Final thought on this and the title of the book, Lessons in Hope. At the time of John Paul II's canonization, the Wall Street Journal asked me to write an op-ed piece for the Saturday edition on the day before the canonization. And my original reaction was to say no. I mean, what could I possibly say 1,600 pages later? And then, the more I reflected upon that, the more it occurred to me that, and reflected on that through the prism, what does he have to teach us now in 2014? it occurred to me that what he had to teach us was the great lesson, the great theme, I suppose you would say, that had driven his own priestly ministry, his episcopate in Krakow, and his service to the Universal Church as Pope. And that was the notion that you should never, ever submit to the tyranny of the notion that some things just are the way they are and you can't do anything about it. This is the only thing possible. I called it the tyranny of the possible in that op-ed piece. And if you look at his pontificate, I think you see that resistance to the tyranny of the possible at work in any number of ways. I've already mentioned World Youth Day. No one in the Catholic Church, or very few people, imagined on October 16th, 1978, when Karol Wojtyla was elected Pope, that the Catholic Church was on the verge of a new and dynamic moment in its history of pastoral ministry to young people. Because it was just thought, nothing is possible. This is just the way things are. Kids are detached and uninterested. He did not believe that, and we know what resulted. On October 16th, 1978, on a much larger geopolitical scale, no one imagined that within 11 years, the post-war division of Europe would be ended. The wall would be down, Germany would be reunified, and all the rest of it. And yet he refused to accept the tyranny of the possible. This is just the way things are, live with it. And we saw the results. On a cultural level, I think very few people, including most churchmen, believed that the Catholic Church had much to say that the world was willing to listen to in response to the cultural tsunami of the sexual revolution. We just thought, we're just not in the game here. 5 years after his election, we have this remarkable theology of the body articulated in 4 years of audience addresses, which has completely revised Catholic marriage preparation programs. It's had a profound impact on Catholic sacramental theology, but it's also given the world a way to think about our embodiedness as male and female and the complementarity and fruitfulness built into that, that it simply didn't have before he decided that's not the way things have to be. There's something else can be offered here. And I think that's a lesson for all of us today. We're at a moment in perhaps our national history, in world history, in the history of the church, where things are seeming a little turbulent. Don't ever accept the tyranny of the possible. Will, courage, informed by prayer, shaped by grace, inspired by grace, can change things. Virtually everybody in this room, lived through these remarkable years, and we shouldn't forget that. And we should not lose heart. Rather, we should take encouragement and hope from this. Thank you.